Good morning, everybody. Here we got Bio 241. I think there's a little lag in this volume control right here, but I think we got it dialed in pretty well. Well enough, okay. Okay, you can uncover your ears once again. All right, so we had a test last time, and it's graded, it's online. If your grade isn't there, then maybe see me right after class. If it's an ID that you need to show me, then show me your ID, or if you put it in the wrong pile, we'll find it and stick it in the right place in Blackboard. But I think most of that we got figured out already, so that's pretty good. The next exam I'm looking is March 31st. Is that right? I don't know. Maybe I have the wrong schedule right here. That seems a little soon. All right, so I'll work on that over the weekend and see if we can do that. All right, so but let's attend to the topic for today, and that is autonomic nervous system. All right, so a lot of this is a review from anatomy, so I want to review just a few of those things. Let me get the projector. Oh, is it still there? That's still there. Okay, autonomic nervous system. All right, so nervous system controls things very rapidly for a short duration in your body. So I think when you start to study physiology, you're going to notice something that if it takes a long time to take effect, it has a long duration of action. And if something takes immediate effect, it has a short duration of action. That's just kind of an axiom that you can count on. All right, there might be some exceptions to that rule. But for instance, certain drugs that are fast-acting will only have a short duration. Things that might take a while to build up and have an effect in your body will have a longer duration. And the slower things that have, or pharmaceutical agents, for instance, when they take time to develop in your body, typically they're safer. Right? Things that have an immediate action, right, are a little bit more harmful to you in case the dose was miscalculated, for instance. All right, so autonomic nervous system controls things in your body relatively rapidly. The system is augmented because sometimes it's interfaced with a hormone system, which typically is a little bit longer in duration. So in the sympathetic nervous system, we'll look at the neurohormones involved with that. Okay, but autonomic nervous system manages your physiology, manages most of your body. As a matter of fact, there's only one thing that the autonomic nervous system does not control. And you should write that down on this slide. And what is the thing that the autonomic nervous system does not control in your body? And it is the effector organ. So think in terms of effector organ is the skeletal muscle system, right? So skeletal muscles are really the only thing that you have voluntary control over. So everything else is controlled by the autonomic nervous system or by the endocrine system. So what are the effector organs for the autonomic nervous system? This slide says it pretty well. It's smooth muscle, glands, but it leaves something out that's really important. But it's kind of implied by regulating organs and organ systems that contain smooth muscle, glands. There's another kind of tissue as well, and that is cardiac muscle. So those are the three effector organs, smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, and glands. All right, so that's everything else besides skeletal muscle. So we're going to be really interested in knowing a lot about the autonomic nervous system because it controls most things in your body. All right, so smooth muscle maintains a resting tone in the absence of nerve stimulation. So smooth muscle does not necessarily need nervous innervation like skeletal muscle needs nerve innervation in order to contract, to be excited. And as a matter of fact, smooth muscle becomes more sensitive when autonomic nervous system input is cut. We call that denervation hypersensitivity. And there is another effector organ that's controlled by the autonomic nervous system that, again, does not need innervation in order for it to function. The autonomic nervous system can increase its activity or decrease its activity, but it has its own rate of activity all by itself, and that is cardiac muscle, right? So cardiac muscle and smooth muscle are kind of similar in that respect, right? So many types of smooth muscle are spontaneously active, just like cardiac muscle, and contract rhythmically without any autonomic nervous system input. So when we get to cardiovascular system, we'll look and see why that happens, but it has to do with membrane channels. All right, autonomic nervous system input just simply increases or decreases that intrinsic activity. All right, so let's look at autonomic nervous system neurons. And here we're comparing two kinds of nervous systems on this slide right here. So on the top, we see what kind of effector organ? Does that remind anybody of anything? That's a nice skeletal muscle, for instance. And then the figure down here at the bottom, what kind of muscle does that look like? That's smooth muscle. So we're comparing and contrasting skeletal muscle with smooth muscle. This is a nice just review for you. So how many neurons, how many motor neurons does it take to go from this part of the nervous system, and I'm pointing at spinal cord, what part of the nervous system is that? That's central nervous system. So from central nervous system to effector organ, for a somatic motor pathway, how many neurons does it take? Let's count them right here. I see the cell body, okay, and it leaves the ventral root, right? So here's the ventral horn, leaves the ventral root, gets into the spinal nerve, and then it follows all the way to the skeletal muscle. And I do not see a synapse anywhere along this pathway right here. Right, so it takes one neuron, one motor neuron from the CNS to the skeletal muscle. Right, and as a matter of fact, here's the sensory neuron in the skin someplace. Right, and this is a afferent neuron. How does an afferent neuron enter the central nervous system? Through the dorsal root right here. Right, so remember roots carry just one-way traffic. So the dorsal root is always going to be sensory. The ventral root is going to be 100% motor. But, of course, nerves, spinal nerves, carry information both ways. Okay, so bottom line, for somatic motor pathway, and when I say somatic, what do I mean? If the connotation is skeletal muscle, voluntary controlled muscle, because it goes to the more superficial parts of your body, not the deep visceral parts inside cavities. That's what we mean by somatic. Okay. Now here on the bottom, we see an autonomic outflow pathway. And how many nerves does it take to get from the central nervous system to that particular effector organ? In this particular case, it is two, except for one example where it is one that we'll talk about. Okay, but it always requires two. So here we have some nerve cell bodies in this lateral horn of the gray matter of the spinal cord, leaving the ventral root, right? And remember, it goes into the spinal nerve. But for a sympathetic outflow pathway, okay, it enters the sympathetic chain on either side of the vertebral column. And in this particular example, I see a synapse right here. So this is the end of one neuron and the beginning of a second one. And you're going to know a lot about these different kinds of neurons in just a second. And then the second neuron leaves the sympathetic chain, goes the rest of the way to the effector organ, which is smooth muscle in this particular case. Okay, so what is needed? What kind of synapse is this right here? Is anybody familiar with this kind of synapse? What were the two kinds of synapses that we were looking at? There were chemical synapses and electrical synapses. And here I see a space between these two cells, so which kind of synapse does this have to be? It has to be a chemical synapse, right? For electrical synapses, the cells actually have to be touching and have that gap junction between them. So what moves across this space right here? A neurotransmitter, right? So that's really what I want you to be aware of. So here is a bulge, so there's hundreds or thousands of these nerve cell bodies in this part of the sympathetic chain, and it's in the peripheral nervous system. So whenever you have an accumulation of thousands of nerve cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system, what do we call that thing? That's a ganglion, right? So here is a sympathetic ganglion. Here is a dorsal root ganglia, because that's in the peripheral nervous system as well. But in the sympathetic chain ganglia, we have neurotransmitters that carry information across the synapse. So this cell that we see before the ganglion is what we call a preganglionic neuron. The one that exits this ganglion right here is the postganglionic neuron. So we talk about them a little bit differently. We don't say the presynaptic and postsynaptic neuron. We call it the preganglionic and postganglionic neuron. All right, so this is what you're going to see in all autonomic outflow pathways, regardless if it is sympathetic or parasympathetic. It doesn't matter. There's always going to be two neurons. All right, so I know you guys probably should be able to draw this out. Okay, so you've got the sympathetic chain. What are these things right here? Anybody remember? The rami right here's the ventral ramus coming over here. The dorsal ramus will come over here in this particular region. So here are the roots. The rami are the bifurcations of the spinal nerve going to either the posterior or anterior parts of the body. But these right here are what? Oh yeah, rami communicantes, right? So one is white, one is gray. Maybe you can remember. And that's because one of these is myelinated and the other one is not myelinated, right? So the myelination gives it a little bit different color. All right, so you should know which one is myelinated, which one is not myelinated. Okay, so the postganglionic fiber goes from the ganglia all the way to this effector organ right here. All right, divisions within the autonomic nervous system. Well, we have two. Right, sympathetic and parasympathetic. And if you're going to characterize the functional relationship between these two divisions of the autonomic system, well, how would you characterize it in just one word? They are usually, maybe not 100%, but usually they are antagonistic to each other. So that should be on this slide someplace. Oh, yeah, that's a nice first point right here. It has antagonistic effects. Now, is that a feudal system or is that a beautiful system that works nicely? It's beautiful, right? Because when you have antagonism in a control system, what do you have? You have two things that are real important. It's not a topic that's in your book, but I mention it all the time. What does antagonism in a control system provide for you? The concept of balance and precise control. Balance and precise control, and maybe we'll talk about that when we look at this chapter right here. Like, how do you maintain balance and precise control in your automobile? With a brake and the gas pedal, right? And a lot of these systems now are controlled by computers, right? Not necessarily just steel cables. You've probably heard of various companies where the cars just all of a sudden started to accelerate without control because a computer or some kind of sensing module went nuts, all right? But what's the beautiful thing about a well-designed antagonistic system? And that is, if there is noise inputted into the sympathetic and parasympathetic, or if there is noise, a noise signal, an aberrant signal, introduced to the accelerator in a car and the brake at the same time, what is the effect? If it's a nonsense signal, the same amplitude, same magnitude, injected into both the antagonistic systems, what's the effect on the car going to be? Or what's the effect in your body going to be? Because how do these work with each other? By opposing each other. So what's going to happen to that nonsense signal when they're mixed together? They're going to cancel out, right? So if you apply the gas pedal and the brake pedal to the same degree, they're going to cancel each other out. So that noise signal disappears. That's the beauty of having an antagonistic system like that. Okay. So the sympathetic nervous system could be qualified as the fight or flight and stress nervous system, and the parasympathetic is what we call the rest and repose or rest and digest. So this is probably a really good way to think of these two different nervous systems and their general effects in the body. So if you're presented with a life-threatening situation, what do you think should happen to your heart rate? Should it decrease or should it increase? It should increase, right? So that you can fly away or fight the response, right? And what about pupil diameter? Should your pupils, the iris controls your pupil, right? Should your iris constrict to let less light in, or should it dilate to let a lot of light in so that you can perceive everything around you? So dilation, right? And what about blood flow to muscles? Should increase, right? What about your digestive system when you're running away? Should you be concerned about digesting breakfast? Absolutely, but that's probably not the best thing, right? So digestive system is inhibited. Right? So sympathetic nervous system does go there and it inhibits. So the sympathetic nervous system is not always excitatory. Sometimes it is excitatory, sometimes it is inhibitory. It all depends on the particular organ system that we're talking about. Now the thing that you can almost take for granted 100% of the time is if the sympathetic nervous system is excitatory on an organ, what can you tell me about the parasympathetic nervous system? It will be inhibitory, right? So you can't always tell if a nervous system is going to be excitatory or inhibitory, but the other nervous system is going to be opposing it. That is something that most of the times is true. All right, so when the parasympathetic nervous system is excited, that stimulates digestion, right? And that puts you in a calm mood. Okay, so that's a good way to characterize these two divisions. Let's look at a little bit more detail with the sympathetic division. And if you got to break out your anatomy books, that's okay, but signals leave the central nervous system from the spinal cord. Spinal cord only between levels of T1 to L2. Now, what the heck does that mean, T1? Thoracic region, right? The first thoracic space down to L2. So sometimes we call it the thoracolumbar nervous system or the thoracolumbar division. And so the preganglionic fibers leave through this region, and then they move into this sympathetic chain right over here. Sometimes we call these the paravertebral because they're on either side of the vertebral column. This is only one place where you can have a ganglion.
We'll
talk about another place where there can be a ganglia in just a second. Okay, the sympathetic nervous system, when it becomes activated, the whole nervous system becomes activated. So we call it mass activation. And that's because there are signals when it leaves the central nervous system diverge to most sympathetic fibers, and it can then reconverge together. So the sympathetic nervous system is characterized by this divergence and convergence of signals to send sympathetic signals everywhere in your body. So let's just take a look at divergence. Where do we see divergence in this particular figure? Well, we got the nice sympathetic nervous system leaving the ventral root, okay? And this fiber right here is a myelinated fiber, so the preganglionic fiber is myelinated. Unfortunately, this textbook's not an anatomy book, and they got the communicantes wrong, right? The white ramus is this one over here. The gray ramus is really the first proximal one to the spinal cord. So the preganglionic fiber enters the sympathetic chain, but this is the important point. When it enters the sympathetic chain, what happens to that nerve fiber? It has a number of options, right? It can go up a number of divisions within the sympathetic chain, or it can descend a number of divisions. All right, so this is what? Divergence of that signal to many different levels in your body. Or it can actually leave right at this particular division to go to a second ganglion someplace. Notice that there's no synapse right here on this fiber in the paravertebral or the sympathetic chain. It passes right here. But how many nerve fibers does it take to get from the central nervous system to effector organ? At least two, right? There's always going to be two. Well, not at least, it's two. So if there's no synapse in the sympathetic chain, it has to enter a ganglia some other place in the body, and these are what we call the prevertebral ganglia, usually right in front of the spinal cord. And what's the name of a nerve that carries preganglionic fibers from the sympathetic chain into a prevertebral ganglia? And it's going to have different names, but the root of all these nerves is going to be a splanchnic nerve, right? So splanchnic nerve always interconnects sympathetic signals from the sympathetic chain to some prevertebral ganglia where it synapses, and that's where the postganglionic fiber begins in the prevertebral ganglia in this particular case. So don't forget about a splanchnic nerve. All right, so we see divergence of signals. So this sympathetic information spreading what? The flight or fight response everywhere in your body. And it can also be convergence. What do we see happening here? We see that nerves can reform. All right, but also in this ganglia, there can be other nerves that synapse on this postganglionic fiber. So it's receiving information not just from this one nerve, but from nerves from all over the place, right, to stimulate the digestive system in this particular case. All right, so what's another thing that you should appreciate on this slide? Well, the preganglionic fiber is myelinated, and it's shown in the solid line. The postganglionic fiber is non-myelinated. So what can you tell me about the speed of conduction in this non-myelinated fiber right here?
Faster.
It's slow, right? And the speed in this myelinated fiber here is fast. Okay. All right, so on this figure, we see the sympathetic chain ganglia over here, right? It's going to be on either side of the vertebral column. They're like auxiliary spinal cords for sympathetic outflow. But we also see some ganglia that are in front of the vertebral column, and as a matter of fact, they're anterior even to the aorta right here. These are what we call the prevertebral ganglia. So the postganglionic fiber originates either within the sympathetic chain or these prevertebral ganglia. Those are the only two places where the postganglionic fiber can originate from. So going back to this last figure, all right, so the sympathetic nervous system is also characterized as having relatively short preganglionic fibers and relatively long postganglionic fibers, if you're just going to look at that structure, right? So short preganglionic and relatively long postganglionic fibers. We're going to contrast that with the parasympathetic nervous system. The only time where you don't have a true postganglionic fiber is in the sympathoadrenal system. But this kind of also emphasizes the divergence of sympathetic outflow to your whole body. Okay, so there is a nerve that goes to the adrenal medulla. Can you picture where the adrenal gland is? The adrenal gland is right above the kidney, and it's got two divisions. There's the cortical division and the medullary division, right? So the cortex is superficial. The medulla is where? Is the deep part of that organ. And the deep part of that organ has special cells that are called chromaffin cells. And when a sympathetic nerve excites that region, those chromaffin cells don't send an electrical impulse to another part of the body. They depolarize, and when they depolarize, they secrete sympathetic neurotransmitters directly into the blood. And these are epinephrine, mostly epinephrine, and 15% norepinephrine. And these have different names. Epinephrine, since it comes from the adrenal gland, sometimes is called adrenaline. Right? So sometimes it's called adrenaline because it comes from the adrenal medulla. And maybe you felt the effects of adrenaline at some point in your life. Okay, maybe driving down the 405 freeway. When would you experience a big surge of adrenaline? You're minding your own business, right? And then all of a sudden, you have a semi-tractor trailer truck on your right and on your left, and they want to be where you are. And you're driving a nice little small car, they don't see you, and you think you're going to get squished between these two big trucks, right? And it looks like there's no way out, and you're going to die. So what happens to your heart? It speeds up, right? Not only does it speed up, but the force of contraction increases. It could almost be like jumping out of your chest, right, if you really think you're going to get crushed. All right? And that's because not only are there nerves that go to stimulate the heart, but these sympathetic nerves go to the adrenal medulla, and it causes this big release of adrenaline, which is epinephrine, and noradrenaline to a lesser degree, which is called norepinephrine. And now these hormones will last for a prolonged period of time, right? So this is a good example of how the nervous system interfaces with the endocrine system, because these really aren't considered neurotransmitters because they're being secreted from chromaffin cell, which is a modified neuron. So you could actually think of them as neurotransmitters, but because they're released into the blood, they act more like a hormone. That's the definition of a hormone. It's released into this blood, and when it's in the blood, where does it go? Everywhere in your body. So it then delivers that sympathetic signal to every tissue in your body, including your heart. And the endocrine system is typical of a system that lasts for a long period of time. So you might be under the influence of that adrenaline for quite a while. Even if you pull off the side of the road, your heart will beat for maybe 30 minutes or more at an accelerated rate because of that. Okay, so this system right here is kind of interesting because it shows you that there's a special interface. This is an example of that interface between the nervous system and endocrine system. And because there is no true postganglionic fiber, that postganglionic fiber are just the cells of the adrenal medulla. Right? But this also underscores the point of mass activation, because where does this epinephrine and norepinephrine go? Everywhere in your body, right? It's just carried by the blood because your blood goes everywhere. Okay, so here we see the the agonists of the sympathetic nervous system, which is epinephrine and norepinephrine. The basic building block is tyrosine, an amino acid. That's an essential amino acid. You have to have that in your diet. You can't make that yourself. Then it's converted into DOPA. Who knows what this reaction is right here? We're just adding NOH group right here. What is that? Can you call that an oxidation reaction? Okay. No, we don't want to say. I don't want to say. Okay, but there's an OH group that's put right here. Okay, then a little bit of a, then we have a decarboxylation, right, another oxidation reaction, and then a methylation right here, so we can convert norepinephrine into epinephrine very easily with the building block starting with tyrosine. All right, so these molecules have different activity because the shape of the molecule changes just significantly enough, right, to change how it binds to a particular receptor. Okay, let's go to the parasympathetic nervous system. All right, sometimes we call this the cranial sacral division because the outflow is from cranial nerves. And if you're going to pick one cranial nerve where parasympathetic outflow comes from, which cranial nerve would you pick? Probably from anatomy, hopefully you could recall. Yeah, vagus, which is cranial nerve number 10. Okay. And also there is parasympathetic outflow between sacral 2 and 4. Right, so therefore we say it's the cranial sacral division. There is no parasympathetic outflow through the lumbar division or the thoracic division like sympathetic outflow that we just saw. Okay, but nonetheless, how many neurons does it take to get from the central nervous system to an effector organ? It's still going to be 2, right? Any autonomic outflow requires 2 neurons. And where the synapses between the two neurons is a ganglia, right? These ganglia for a parasympathetic nervous system is right on the surface of the effector organ or even inside the effector organ. So for the parasympathetic nervous system, the neurons, the preganglionic neurons are relatively long, they're myelinated, right? And the postganglionic neurons are really short because they already exist in the organ that they're innervating, right? So they only have to travel a microscopic distance. Okay, one in particular nerve that somebody mentioned already is the vagus nerve, right? Leaving through cranial nerve number 10. The vagus nerve right there comes from a word which means vagabond. What does a vagabond do? Travels around all over the place, right? Without too many worries or cares. But the important point here is that it travels around. So here's the vagus nerve coming down next to the jugular and the carotid right here, and then it starts to bifurcate to all different kinds of organs. So it innervates the heart, esophagus, pancreas, small intestine, upper half of the large intestine. All right, but the lower divisions over here are innervated from outflow from the sacral divisions of the parasympathetic nervous system. Right, so your body is basically broken up into 2 different regions according to the parasympathetic nervous system. But vagabond just means that the vagus nerve you can find in all of these different organs right here, all these superior organs. All right, so this slide right here, I think this is from your book. It looks almost like I got it from a different textbook, but it just shows the anatomy of the autonomic nervous system. Here is thoracolumbar, which is which one? Sympathetic, right? And then we got cranial sacral outflow. That's the parasympathetic. All right, the solid lines represent preganglionic fibers that are fast because they're myelinated. The dotted lines represent the postganglionic fibers that are unmyelinated. All right, so you can see blue, right? Blue is parasympathetic and they're relatively long. Preganglionics, the postganglionics are very, very short, because the ganglia is within the target tissue itself. All right, so you also see sympathetic ganglia right here, again, involved with the sympathetic nervous system. And the solid line we see in this division right here passes right through the sympathetic chain going to the prevertebral ganglia in this particular case. So what are these nerves called that connect the sympathetic chain and the prevertebral ganglia? They're always going to be splanchnic nerves, okay? But it always requires 2 nerves to get to an effector organ. The other thing that maybe you can appreciate on this slide is, okay, for instance, the eyeball right here, How many different colored neurons do you see going there? There are two. Most organs are dually innervated. They receive both parasympathetic and sympathetic innervation. All right, and what about this parotid gland right here? How many divisions do you see going to it? Two different colors, both parasympathetic and sympathetic. All right. The exception to that is this adrenal medulla. There's no parasympathetic innervation of the adrenal medulla, and it's only, the preganglionic fiber going to the adrenal medulla. And do you see a dotted line anywhere in here? Okay, this is that exception, okay, to the rule where it says that you always need two neurons, right, for any kind of autonomic outflow. In this particular case, the chromaffin cells of the adrenal medulla are acting like the postganglionic sympathetic fibers. When they get stimulated, what do? They release epinephrine and norepinephrine directly into the blood. So they're acting like the analog to the postganglionic fibers of the sympathetic nervous system. So the adrenal medulla is not dually innervated, that you see most other organs are. Okay. So that's kind of nice. Here is a table that kind of lists out what the effects of the two divisions of the autonomic nervous system are. And you should probably see that there is a lot of antagonism. For instance, on salivary glands, sympathetic decreases secretion. All right, so it's inhibitory on secretion of salivary glands. But what is parasympathetic stimulation? It's going to be opposite, right? So that increases. So you can't tell which one is going to be excitatory, which one's going to be inhibitory. You just know that they're going to be antagonistic to each other. But what should you use as an overall guide to think about whether sympathetic is going to be excitatory or inhibitory on an organ? Think of those two general ways that we characterize it, either the fight and flight response or the rest and digest response. Okay, so for instance, let's look at lungs. There are bronchioles. These are tubes that don't have cartilage on them, but it has smooth muscle that can contract, right? And then that occludes that particular airway, or when those muscles relax, it opens up those airways. All right, so what would you like to be able to do for sympathetic, for the fight and flight response? Would you like to increase ventilation or decrease ventilation? Make it harder to breathe or easier to breathe? Easier to breathe, so sympathetic activity causes dilation, inhibits those smooth muscles, so those bronchioles dilate, it's easier to breathe. And what about parasympathetic? Oh, is constriction, right? So that should make sense. What about the heart? Let's take a look at the heart. Sympathetic increases, that certainly makes sense. Parasympathetic decreases the heart rate. Right, and conduction through conduction fibers through the heart is increased with sympathetic, is decreased with parasympathetic. But here's an interesting case. The force of contraction or contractility of the heart, of course, is stimulated with sympathetic fibers, but the parasympathetic nervous system has no effect on that because parasympathetic fibers don't go to the ventricles, it only goes to the atria. What do you have in the atria that regulates the rate of the heart? Maybe you could think of that from anatomy. Yeah, you have the SA node, which is the pacemaker, right? And that changes the heart rate. So heart rate is controlled antagonistically, but the force of contraction is not, because only the sympathetic nervous system goes to the ventricles. All right, so I think you should look over this table and look at some of the effects of sympathetic and parasympathetic, but I don't want to read all these different things to you. All right, so just as important as knowing some of the gross anatomy of the autonomic nervous system, we've got to look at neurotransmitters. Okay, so where do you have neurotransmitters in the autonomic nervous system? And that is any place where you have a chemical synapses. So where do you have chemical synapses? You have chemical synapses in ganglia and then also at the axon terminus of the postganglionic fiber. So let's look at this slide, and this is a really good exam figure. Okay, so all preganglionic fibers within these ganglia right here release a neurotransmitter we call acetylcholine. And you're kind of familiar with acetylcholine because you had to know something about nicotinic receptors for that last test. And all of these receptors right here are nicotinic receptors that bind acetylcholine. And when a nicotinic receptor is stimulated, what happens to this postganglionic cell? What happens when two molecules of acetylcholine bind to a nicotinic receptor? It opens up a channel. Yeah, opens up a channel, and then what happens when that channel is open? Sodium rushes inside the cell, and what do we call that? That's depolarization or an excitatory event on the cell. So acetylcholine is excitatory on all of these ganglia right here. It doesn't matter if it's these kind, which is the red one. What does the red stand for? Sympathetic, because it is what? Thoracolumbar, as well as these blue, which is cranial sacral. What kind of outflow is cranial sacral? That is parasympathetic, right? So it doesn't matter if it's parasympathetic or sympathetic. Okay, so all preganglionic fibers are what we call cholinergic because they release acetylcholine. All right, so all of these, whether they're solid blue or solid red, these are cholinergic fibers. Why is that? Because they release acetylcholine in these ganglia. Right, most sympathetic postganglionics, which one are the postganglionics? The ones with this dotted line right here are postganglionic fibers. Right, and if we look at the sympathetic division, we see that it releases norepinephrine. Right, so these are what we call adrenergic because they release norepinephrine. Now there is one exception to this rule, and that is what? The adrenal medullary system, where there is no postganglionic fiber. Why is that? Because these cells right here in the adrenal medulla are really not neurons. They're more like endocrine cells. We call those chromaffin cells that directly release epinephrine and norepinephrine into the extracellular space. And then by diffusion, epinephrine, norepinephrine enters the circulation. And then where does it go? Everywhere, right? Even if there's an organ that doesn't have sympathetic nerve innervation, right, it can still be controlled by the sympathetic nervous system because the blood goes everywhere in the body. All right, now what about the postganglionic parasympathetic fibers that we see here in blue? These all release acetylcholine. So what kind of neuron is this, the blue dotted line? Is that adrenergic or cholinergic fiber? That nerve fiber is a cholinergic fiber because it releases acetylcholine. All right, so make sure you know all these different neurotransmitters that are used, and especially this exception to the rule right here, the adrenal medullary system. Okay, so here we have some smooth muscles, and here we have a sympathetic neuron. Here we have a parasympathetic neuron. And this one good example might be in the digestive system that receives dual innervation. These synapses are different than the typical kinds of synapses that we first started to look at because there is no axon terminus here that contains neurotransmitter in vesicles. Neurotransmitter in vesicles is stored along the whole length of this axon right here. So this is what we call a varicosity, and that forms a synapse with these smooth muscle cells. So if an action potential moves down this axon, all of these varicosities then will release neurotransmitter, right? So, and that's true for both the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. So when we have synapses kind of built upon each other like a chain of pearls right here, we call that synapsis en passant, or synapses in passing as that action potential moves. Now, smooth muscles are sort of interesting. They're different than skeletal muscle. If we stimulate a skeletal muscle by releasing acetylcholine in the neuromuscular junction, what is a skeletal muscle going to do all the time? It's going to depolarize and then it's going to contract. A skeletal muscle can never make up its mind whether it should contract or not. Like if you're really thirsty and you reach out for a water bottle using skeletal muscle, did you ever realize that that skeletal muscle says, no, I don't want to have a drink of water right now at this particular time? What's it going to do? It's just going to contract, right? Because every time an action potential reaches the neuromuscular junction, it's going to cause contraction of a skeletal muscle. So skeletal muscles follow your conscious control. They can't make up their own mind. But smooth muscles, on the other hand, can make up their own mind depending on the balance of signals from the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. So let's look. Here we have a sympathetic nerve fiber, which is releasing norepinephrine. And I see some receptors on the membrane right here. Ooh, what kind of receptor does that look like? Do you see enough of the shape of this receptor right here to tell me, does it look like an ionotropic kind of receptor, like a nicotinic receptor that's just an ion channel? Or does it look more like it's involving metabolism and changing of chemicals inside the cell? We call that a metabotropic receptor. Does it look like just a simple ion channel? It looks like a G protein to me, okay? So these receptors for norepinephrine and acetylcholine, even acetylcholine right here, are G protein coupled receptors. And this smooth muscle cell, okay, can look at the effects of parasympathetic stimulation and sympathetic stimulation, right? And will mix these signals together, and then it will make a decision whether or not it's going to contract based on which signal is stronger. All right, so if this is a smooth muscle, for instance, in the digestive tract, where these G-protein-coupled receptors are excitatory and these from the sympathetic nervous system are inhibitory, these signals are mixed together, and smooth muscle then will make up its own mind whether it's going to contract based on information from both the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. Okay, so that's a big difference between skeletal muscle and smooth muscle. We'll look at that in some more detail when we get to smooth muscle. Let's look in particular at signals from sympathetic postganglionic fibers, which are what? Adrenergic. Okay, so those fibers will be releasing primarily norepinephrine. And in order for that norepinephrine to work across the synapse, what does the postsynaptic cell, or what does that effector cell have to have in order to be sensitive to norepinephrine? It's got to have a receptor, right? So there has to be adrenergic receptors on the effector organ in order for norepinephrine to have some kind of effect on it. Okay, so adrenergic stimulation, which is the result of norepinephrine being released from a postganglionic fiber, sometimes causes excitation, sometimes causes inhibition, depending on the particular tissue. And we have a number of tissues down here that we're going to look at. So this is kind of a conundrum, because how can one neurotransmitter, namely norepinephrine, have different effects on different tissues? Why is it possible? So that's a good question you should pose for yourself, and we'll answer that today. And I think now is a good time. All right, it can have different effects because different effectors will have different kinds of receptors. So there are different kinds of adrenergic receptors in different tissues. So sometimes norepinephrine will be excitatory, sometimes it will be inhibitory, depending on the receptor type in the effector organ. And this information is crucial for the rest of your life, all right? So you might think this is just too complicated to know, but it's really not too complicated to know. And it's something you got to be really familiar with, right? Because if you're not, then instead of helping people in the hospital, guess what you're going to do? You're going to clear the hospital out, because everybody's going to die, right? So you got to know these receptor types. Okay, so there are two major kinds of receptor types. There's alpha and beta, adrenergic receptors. And furthermore, there are even subtypes of these different kinds of receptors. All right, so there's alpha 1, alpha 2, there's beta 1, beta 2, and we'll get you working on some facility with these different kinds of receptors. One thing that's nice, all of these receptors are G protein coupled receptors. They work through second messenger systems. So what's the first messenger going to be on these receptors right here? What's the first messenger that's going to change the physiology of the cells that have these adrenergic receptors? Where's the first messenger, and where do we always find it? Okay, we're talking about sympathetic fibers that are adrenergic. What's the neurotransmitter used by adrenergic fibers? Adrenergic fibers are always going to use norepinephrine. Okay, so norepinephrine is the first messenger. It's stuck outside the cell, so it binds to a cell membrane receptor, which is an adrenergic receptor, G protein coupled receptor. So the first messenger is norepinephrine. But depending on the receptor, the second messenger changes. Where do you find the second messenger? Inside the cell, right? So it's going to build up as a result of norepinephrine binding to the receptor and that G-protein coupled receptor. So beta receptors use cyclic AMP. Okay, have you heard of cyclic AMP? Yeah, even on the first test, I think you had to memorize a list of second messengers. And then we looked at a mechanism on the last test of a second messenger. What is the name of the enzyme that gets activated in the cell membrane to produce cyclic AMP from ATP? And that was adenylate cyclase, right? That gets activated. So these beta receptors use cyclic AMP as a second messenger, while the alpha adrenergic receptors use calcium as a second messenger, right? And just calcium in an ionic form is what? Just a divalent cation. It's always just going to be a divalent cation. All right, so both calcium and cyclic AMP are really efficient and good second messengers that we find inside the cell when it's stimulated by norepinephrine. So let's look at some things right here. And I can almost kind of see this one here. The heart, all right, with sympathetic activity, what happens to your heart when you have sympathetic tone increasing to the heart? You have increased heart rate and force of contraction. Okay, both of these, because it goes to the atrium as well as the ventricles, you have a beta receptor, okay, and we call that a beta 1 receptor. So beta 1 receptor is going to be excitatory, right? And it just say, and you could probably memorize that, a beta 1 receptor is always going to be excitatory on the effector organ. Let's look at a beta 2. Where do we have beta 2? Here we have beta 2 in the lungs, in bronchioles. All right, in fight or flight response due to sympathetic outflow, what should happen to your airways in the lungs? Should they dilate to increase ventilation or should they constrict to make it harder to breathe? They should dilate. And how can you dilate a bronchiole? That is by inhibiting smooth muscles of bronchioles so that the bronchioles dilate. It's easier to get air in and out of your lungs. So the bronchioles can't have beta 1 receptors because those are excitatory. They have a different kind of receptor, right? It's still a G protein coupled receptor, but it's a beta 2. And beta 2 inhibits that smooth muscle, causes dilation of bronchioles. All right, so what's a good way to remember that? What tissue has beta 1 receptors that are excitatory? Your heart. How many hearts do you have? You got one. Okay? What organ has beta 2 receptors that inhibit the smooth muscle in that organ to increase its function in the fight or flight mode? So lungs. How many lungs do you have? You've got two. All right, so you should be able to now make a connection pretty easily where you find these different receptors until it becomes just, all right, like your first language, which will happen in a couple of years. Doesn't have to happen for the test because now you know beta 1 are in the heart, beta 2 are in the lungs. Okay, one is excitatory, the other is inhibitory. So you still have to appreciate that mechanism. For alpha receptors, we're only going to be interested in alpha 1 and not alpha 2 in this class. Alpha 2 are central receptors in the brain, and we're still trying to figure out all the effects of alpha 2 receptors, so I can only give you nice, concise information on alpha 1. Okay, alpha 1 are going to be excitatory, right, in every particular case. So you have when we look at eyes, maybe you've looked at eyes in lab yet, I'm not really sure, but there are different kinds of fibers in the eye, and the ones that cause contraction are the radial fibers of the iris, which pulls the iris open. Okay, those are alpha 1, so it's excitatory on alpha 1. In arterioles, in skin and visceral vessels, they constrict because they have alpha 1 receptors. So does that make sense? Should you have a lot of blood flow going to skin and to digestive system when you're in the fight or flight mode? No, where should blood be going? It's to skeletal muscle, right? So your digestive system is shut down because it doesn't have blood supply because they have alpha 1 receptors. Okay, so that's pretty important. We're going to look at this one, okay, in the liver. Has both alpha 1 and beta 2 receptors, right? They increase glycogenolysis and secretion of glucose. We're going to particularly look at this mechanism, I don't, probably not in this chapter, but in a following chapter. All right, so I do want you to know something about alpha 1, our excitatory. Beta 1 is excitatory. What about beta 2? Inhibitory, right? But you should also know the second messengers in each of these different kinds of receptors. So here is another exam figure to help you remember this. All right, so what kind of system does this look like? Does this look like a somatic or voluntary outflow system or an autonomic system? And why? You see two neurons back to back. What's that a hallmark of? Autonomic outflow. So what are these neurons right here called? The preganglionic. Here are the postganglionic neurons, right, in any kind of autonomic outflow. And that's true whether it is parasympathetic or sympathetic that we have in this example over here. All right, so all preganglionic neurons, whether it's sympathetic or parasympathetic, how would we characterize these? These are all cholinergic because they release what? Acetylcholine. So here I see some neurotransmitters diffusing across the synapse, and it's always going to be acetylcholine. So these are all cholinergic neurons, and the receptors in the postganglionic fiber is going to always be a nicotinic receptor. So when it binds acetylcholine, that causes depolarization, right, which then sets up an action potential down to the axon terminus of the postganglionic fiber. But now here things change. If it's a parasympathetic outflow, the postganglionic fiber is not going to release norepinephrine, it's going to release acetylcholine, right? So the postganglionic fiber is cholinergic as well, but all of these sympathetic fibers right here are adrenergic because they release norepinephrine. Okay, so depending on where the, well, as a matter of fact, all receptors and effector organs for the autonomic nervous system are G-protein coupled receptors. And these are different than nicotinic receptors. Since they're G-protein coupled, they're stimulated by a compound we call muscarin. So these are what we call muscarinic receptors. So these are G-protein coupled receptors. And these different mechanisms can either be excitatory or inhibitory depending on how that G-protein is coupled to the physiology inside the cell. Okay, so on the heart, you can say that parasympathetic nervous system is inhibitory to the heart. It slows the heart rate down. But we have to get to the cardiovascular chapter to see how that happens. But that's a muscarinic type receptor as opposed to the nicotinic type that we have on the dendrites and cell bodies of these postganglionic fibers. All right, what about these receptors down here for the adrenergic system? Are any of these just simple ion channels that open up? No, these are all G-protein coupled receptors, right? And it works through different second messenger systems. Sometimes it's calcium, sometimes it's cyclic AMP, and probably you should know which one is which. The alpha receptors work through what kind of second messenger? It's going to be cyclic AMP, and the betas work through, oh, no, I have it backwards. The alphas are calcium, and the betas work through cyclic AMP, second messengers inside the cell. So what did we say about alpha-1s in particular? These are going to be excitatory, right? It stimulates vasoconstriction in the viscera and skin. Beta-1s are excitatory, increases heart rate, as well as force of contraction because these postganglionic fibers go to both the atria and the ventricles, increasing both the chronotropy and inotropy of the heart. What's chronotropy of the heart refer to? That's kind of a blast from the past. I should have used that before in this discussion. Chronotropy, what's a chronograph? It's a wristwatch, right? What do you do with a wristwatch? You look at time, you measure time or rate of something, right? So chronotropy is adjusting the rate of the heart, and that is independent of force of contraction, and that's what we call the inotropic effect on the heart. So inotropy is force of contraction, chronotropy is rate of contraction. So beta 1 receptors increase both the chronotropy of the heart as well as what? The inotropy of the heart, the contractility. Now what about the lungs? You don't have beta 1, you have beta 2 receptors, right? So norepinephrine inhibits the smooth muscle of bronchioles, causing them to dilate, which increases perfusion. So this is a kind of nice slide because it just ties all of those different concepts together. Okay, acetylcholine is used at all motor neurons, right? It's for the skeletal muscles and the voluntary nervous system, all preganglionics, in the parasympathetic postganglionic fibers. And you got two kinds of cholinergic receptors. You got nicotine, which is just an ionotropic, means it just opens up an ion channel so sodium can enter the cell, which then in skeletal muscle always reaches threshold, but it will make the cell more excitable, for instance, if it's a smooth muscle. Okay. Well, we don't have any nicotinic receptors on smooth muscle. Forget about that. It's blocked by curare. Curare binds to the receptor, and it then excludes acetylcholine from binding to that receptor. So then that motor neuron can no longer control that skeletal muscle. It's been poisoned, so the skeletal muscle can't contract. All right, so curare is what we call an antagonist to acetylcholine at the receptor. And the second kind are G-protein-coupled receptors, which are muscarinic. And they're stimulated by a compound that is similar to acetylcholine, but just a little bit different shape. It binds to the receptor, and then it excludes the binding of acetylcholine to that receptor, and it blocks transmission, synaptic transmission. So it's a poison, and it came from mushrooms, and so that's how it got its name. And it can be blocked by a different compound, which we call atropine. So atropine can be used as an antidote to that kind of poisoning. So here are some different kinds of receptors for acetylcholine. On the left-hand side over here, we have just a typical nicotinic type of receptor, right? So when it binds two molecules of acetylcholine, that causes a conformation change of this channel. It opens up so that the primary effect is sodium entering the cell, which causes depolarization. And how do you understand depolarization? What kind of event is that? That's excitatory because it moves the cell up toward threshold, right? So nicotinic receptors always produce excitation, as opposed to receptors over here, which are of the muscarinic type. It's always going to be what? A G protein coupled receptor. And we need one molecule of acetylcholine binding to the receptor that's going to activate the G protein over here, right? So the alpha unit and the beta gamma are going to move away from the receptor. They're going to dissociate, and they can float around inside the membrane, right? They can wander around inside the membrane, because what model of a membrane do you want to use right now? How about something that has fluid in it, like the fluid mosaic model? A membrane is very fluid, so things can diffuse around on the surface or inside the membrane. And these activated G proteins can bump into a potassium channel. And in this particular case, this potassium channel closes. So when it's opened and potassium leaves the cell, so this is before, right, before this G protein is activated, this potassium channel is open. What state is this cell in when potassium is leaving? It is hyperpolarizing, right? It's in a hyperpolarized state. When it's hyperpolarized, is that an excited state or inhibited state? Inhibited, because it's driven farther away from threshold, right? So this cell is inhibited, but when this activated G protein bumps into this potassium channel, it can change conformation, it can close. So what happens to hyperpolarization then when this potassium channel closes? Hyperpolarization stops, all right? And what's the opposite of hyperpolarization? Depolarization. So depolarization can be caused by closing of these potassium channels in the resting state when it becomes excited. That can cause depolarization. But what's another way of causing depolarization? When these activated G proteins bump into a sodium channel, and it causes a sodium channel to open, right? So when a sodium channel opens, that causes depolarization. And what do you know about depolarization? Is it excitatory or inhibitory? It's going to be excitatory because it pushes the cell up toward threshold. Okay, so that produces excitation. So these muscarinic receptors right here, depending on the tissue, sometimes can be inhibitory or excitatory, depending on what kinds of membrane channels are placed in the membrane right here, right? Whether they're leak channels for potassium, right, or sodium channels, which are typically closed. So if there's sodium channels that are typically closed, that's going to excite the cell. But if it's a leak channel for potassium that closes upon acetylcholine binding the receptor, right, then that's going to actually excite the cell. Okay. So this table right here, you know, I don't think I have really anything on the test with these different receptors. But you should at least be aware that there are different kinds of cholinergic receptors. There's that nicotinic type and muscarinic type, and probably know where these different receptors are located. So skeletal muscle always has a nicotinic receptor, can never make up its mind whether it's going to contract or not, right? As soon as acetylcholine binds to that nicotinic channel, that causes excitation by allowing sodium to enter the cell. And nicotinic receptors are found in all autonomic ganglia, but the effector organs of the parasympathetic nervous system are G-protein-coupled receptors, and those are what we call muscarinic, because they have a little bit different shape. And these muscarinic receptors can be depolarizing or excitatory or hyperpolarizing, depending on what kind of channel proteins are in the effector organ. Okay, so this might be an exam figure too. I can't remember. All right, but you have a lot of good exam figures to help you get that straightened out. Okay, so if you can't label these right here, then start with a blank piece of paper and draw it out from zero. That will help you remember that. Now, what's the nice thing about knowing something about those exam figures? If you have that exam figure in your mind and you know how to answer it on a test, now you have a key to answer the multiple choice and matching questions on the other part of the test, right? So if you got that key in your mind, knowing those exam figures will help you with the other parts of the test, right? So that's kind of like a key thing. Make sure you know those exam figures. Okay, any questions before you go? Sign-in sheet is going around? Yeah. I'll have to double check. Yeah, because I think they're really helpful. I'll double check on that. Okay. Thanks for reminding me. Thank you.
You got to follow me to my room for some reason. I can't find your test.